for this article over here from JAMA. Now, JAMA is a very respected journal. Everyone knows, like, New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA. Those are, like, the top two. So you would expect it to have very, very significant articles and topics to cover. So this is fascinating, though. We'll look at this little abstract, if you can call it that. I'll call it a paragraph in a moment. But prior to this, this is written in 1960, JAMA 1960. Before 1960, in the 50s or before, so what did people do when there was a cardiac arrest? Now, out on the street, what'd they do? They died, generally, unfortunately. Right? There wasn't anyone doing CPR. It didn't exist. So what about in the hospital? Right? If there was an arrest, cardiac arrest in the hospital, there were hospitals back then. You know, it's definitely before my time, but they existed. And if somebody arrested, anyone know what they do? The option was to open the chest, do a thoracotomy, get your hands on the heart, and do direct cardiac massage. That's what was done. That was the only way to keep the circulation going. Comes along this landmark article in 1960 in JAMA, and they discovered that you could do this. First, they did some animal studies, believe it or not, and then they came to conclude that you could do CPR. You could do closed chest cardiac resuscitation. And what intrigues me about this article is, like, this would never make it past peer review in our time. Something written as almost sales-like, salesperson-like. It's very silly, right? The use of this technique on 20 patients has given an overall permanent survival rate of 70%. We'll talk about that in a second. Anyone, anywhere can now initiate cardio-resuscitated procedures. All that's needed are two hands. It's like a joke. But the part that's really misleading about this landmark article is that 70%. Anyone have an idea what is the quoted survival? Right, so for adults, if you look at various studies, that would be the average, about 10%. You're right, because it's, it ranges. Some studies say 5, up to, I saw 25. That's really incredible place. I think it was Columbia. But between 5 and 25, that's what's quoted. Average around 10 to 15. Pediatrics do a little better, and it's up to 50%. Now, why is in-house arrests, we're not going to talk about this too much, but it is worth knowing this. In-house arrests are much better prognosis. I don't even want to tell you the percentages. I don't want to discourage anyone from doing CPR outside the hospital, but the numbers there are very scary when you really look at the data. But why would it be? What's the advantage in-house? So a lot of things. What? Right. I want to see if you say the main one, the one that really made a difference for me, right? There was like, so first of all, timing is usually better, right? Because they're monitors usually, and you know, oh, asystole, we better do something. VFib, we better do something, right? No blood pressure, we better do something, right? Those are all obvious tip-offs, and you're going to know them pretty quickly, right? Unless you go to a bad hospital, right? Where I don't want to say too much of this in the lab, but you know the orange juice sign, right? And what? All right. Better not. All right. Forget that story. But maybe at the end, if we have time. But at the end of the day, the main thing, and I'm saying this has nothing to do with end-of-life decisions, but I really want people to realize this, because it made such a big difference for me in handling arrests. People, let's say, they learn CPR, and every point, I don't know if you do it in medical school, probably should and do, right? Before you start anything on the clerkships or anything like that. And then you'll do it again as an intern, and which is good. The more times you do it, the better. But when you're really doing it, right, for real, which people who work on ambulances rarely do these kind of things, right? In my experience, it was almost never. Once you're in the house, you will be involved in arrests. You will be doing real, genuine CPR. Now, obviously, you're not going to have to do mouth-to-mouth to anybody or anything like that. You know, you could do better. Intubate somebody, use a bag, put them on a ventilator. That's always nice. But in terms of compressions, that's something that people will be doing. The biggest advantage is you get to see whether your compressions are really doing anything. If you have, let's say, an arterial line in, right, you will notice, like I did maybe, how poorly your first attempts are and how much you think you were doing good CPR, but it was terrible. How do you know? Because there's no waveform on the A-line. Everyone know what I'm talking about? You know, like on a monitor, when you the A-line is going to be showing you the arterial blood pressure response, you get to really learn how to do it. So I wanted to just throw that out there, that that's something to watch and be mindful of. It makes a difference between doing effective CPR and ineffective. One time we were driving to Yeshiva, actually, in the back roads of, on the way to Yerushalayim, and one of the Rebbeim was ahead of us. I was in the Rebbe van, right? So, you know, the usual hawk in the Rebbe van about this guy and that guy, whatever. And suddenly we get this call. All, you know, he kept calling frantically. No one was at first picking up their phones, but then we get this call from Rabbi Schneider. He was ahead of us, and he said, quick, tell Rabbi Apfel he's got to get off the bus. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, they're finally throwing me out of yeshiva. They had enough of these trips to America. I don't know what it is. But we get, on the side of the road is this guy who's in cardiac arrest. That's what he meant. So I get off, praying to God that it would be something manageable. And I see this unfortunate, very, very obese, which is going to make this whole thing very challenging, person, Nebuch person, his daughter standing by him crying her head off. And I see these very well-meaning first responders, they're called, guys doing CPR, or quote, CPR. But, you know, they weren't doing anything. And, you know, he didn't make it. And the biggest reason those percentages are so low for these out-of-hospital things, in my view, is because people do inadequate CPR. You got to really push much harder than you think. So bear that in mind when it comes to real CPR. But that has really not our topic. Our topic is more related to the difference between the excitement of that JAMA article in 1960, and then down below, here's something from the New England Journal of Medicine, 1976, right? You guys weren't born, I was just a kid. And they decided, you know, as exciting as it was to discover the CPR, you know, it's not always the greatest thing to have around or to be forced to do. And that they decided, through experience, the medical community, that there are times when it's better not to do it. DNR, right? Better not to resuscitate. Even though we could do it, and they were doing pretty well, let's say up to 25%, and in pediatrics up to 50%, but they discovered that there are cases, and we'll see which cases that they decided this was true for, and currently have decided that it's true for, right? And we're going to see that's where the tension is going to come in. That it's something that we need to regulate. We need to officially put DNR into the medical routine. So nowadays, someone who gets admitted to the hospital, an adult, certainly is already presented with this. Almost for anything, you have to like get this into the chart if possible. So what's the big deal? So the big deal is a classic notion about Yahadus, about halacha. There's a classic notion that DNR is completely under all circumstances out of the question. That to not resuscitate is something that we would never do. Even in a case that's terminal, where we know that the person is not going to like necessarily survive, but to prolong the life, it's still a chiyuv. Lo samad adam re'echa, you have to do it. You have to sustain life. And I remember when I once gave this talk in I forgot what it's called, the YU Students Medical Ethics Society, whatever it was called, you know, the very nice organization. So they had me once talk about this, and I was expecting a bunch, for some reason I didn't know yet what the YU Medical Ethics Society thing was. I thought it was going to be a bunch of smicha guys. That's why I was usually doing, like, you know, contemporary halacha or the, you know, their fourth year halachic thing. And instead, so I had this whole thing prepared for those guys, which was going to be looking at the sugyas of this Mark Silvas and this, that, and the other thing. And instead, I walk in, there's 250 total lay people. I didn't know they were lay people. Everyone's coming over to say hello to me. I remember my old head counselor from camp from 30 years ago, and this guy and that guy. And so I quickly had to switch to a much more Hamish type discussion, like bringing in Mehmet Oz. You know, I get a lot of mileage out of Mehmet Oz and my interactions with him. A few months ago when I came here, right, I started off with the Mehmet Oz story. So there's an angle on that story that really is a great introduction to this issue. I was telling this story about how it was one of my first calls, and I was in the middle of an arrest with this kid who was supposed to be fine, and he wasn't, whatever, but I was like trying to keep him around, and I was sustaining his life. Because again, I had my monitor, doing great CPR, kept doing the right thing with the meds, volume, we're doing it all, keeping them going. And really, what are the two objectives with every arrest? What are the two objectives? If you had to pick two objectives, medical perspective, nothing to do with alcohol. Sustain him, which means keep his vital organs perfused, brain, heart, kidneys, keep them well perfused, which means do good CPR. And two, that's half the job. What? Well, assuming the heart is... what do you mean by that? How are you going to do it? So get the underlying mechanism of the arrest, right? So now he's doing very good with one, but not too hot with number two. I just couldn't figure out what was going on. That's when Mehmet Oz came in and, you know, in a very humble fashion, threw me out of the way and took over and got right to the... He had much more experience than I did, and he knew exactly what was going on, as I was being wishy-washy and wimpy, and he just saved the kid's life. Now, okay, so he saved the kid's life. He got all the credit and the glory, which was well-deserved. You know, he got to the underlying issue, was tamponade. Everyone know what that is? His heart was being compressed by a clot. You know, I was thinking fluid, whatever, and a big rookie mistake. But thank God he was there. He ripped open the chest, took out the clot, kid saved. So everyone's making such a big deal, and he's like putting his arm around me, telling me, don't worry, it happens to everybody, whatever. Yeah, I'm sure it never happened to you, man, but whatever. So then, as I was thinking about it afterwards, I said, wait a second, you know, there's two parts to CPR and to arrests. It's very important to get the underlying cause and correct it, and definitely he did that. But the sustaining of the life, my God, that's chashuv, no? Keeping the organs perfused, of course it is. And Chazal emphasized this. It's a very, very well-known halacha that if you find somebody who is has half an hour left to their life, you've decided, based on your clinical acumen, that you could predict, you know, this guy's going to make it for a half hour, you'd be Mechal Shabbos to save him. And you chayev to save him. Because just sustaining life for whatever finite period of time, every moment has Kedusha, every moment is precious, and it's very, very significant. Now, that is true. Does that lead to the conclusion, then, under all conditions, we try to do that? That's the tension, because that is the classic idea in the Torah. Now, we're going to have to figure it out, because if it's true, the general society has decided very, very decidedly that that's not true, meaning there are many situations, we'll name a few right now on page 2, where they feel that it is not necessarily a good idea at all to sustain life, and we're thinking at all costs you sustain it, then that creates a conflict, right? A conflict that can put people in very difficult situations that I'm going to name a few. But first, let's get the background. What exactly is the general societal view? What will you be hearing from your attendings, right? Here's what you're going to be hearing. There's something called DNR. Now, what exactly is DNR? So you see on the top, DNR encompasses much more than CPR, right? CPR is just like the bottom of the barrel. You know, when you're in the hospital, there's much, much more that you're going to be doing. There's intubation, defibrillation, cardioversion, all sorts of resuscitative drugs, epi, atropine, norepinephrine, all sorts of drugs that you're going to be using. There's dialysis, you know, when you take it to the next level, nutrition, hydration, all of these are going to be involved in potential DNRs. A blanket DNR means, and now it varies a little by states. I brought the New York State definition. What does New York State say? DNR means not to perform CPR. That means that doctors, nurses, emergency personnel will not attempt CPR if the patient's breathing or heartbeat stops. What will happen if you don't do CPR? It's over. So there won't be any point to the rest of it. So an absolute DNR like that means that you're saying, let this person die. If they go into cardiac arrest, just let them die. But in truth, the decisions that we're going to have to make, people are much more creative nowadays with their DNRs, not only Jews, everybody. There can be much more specificity in contemporary DNR so that it's in the chart with much more information usually than just DNR or not. They can specify a lot of other things, and al pi din, you need to be able to assess this. You'll see why. Now, before we get into that, which we're going to get into in a moment, what are the settings that your attendees are going to be telling you you should actually persuade the family to give it to sign a DNR? That's going to be part of the job of the house staff sometime. make them want to do a DNR. Talk them into it, right? So, by the way, don't ever do that. Don't talk anyone into doing DNR, right? Why would you do that? Now, it's really a personal decision, right? Whose decision should it be? Should it be yours? What's driving the doctor to tell you that you should be telling the family or, you know, of this patient, urging them to do a DNR? You're there, you know them well. Like you know the inner workings of their psychological, emotional, spiritual, and religious life. You really don't. You don't have a right to do that. It was always like, to me, when I was like on the bottom of the totem pole, right? First year medical student or something like that. No, like whatever I was, when I had to listen and be told these things, you know, it was very uncomfortable. And I obviously never did it. I was smart enough then not to say that that's my responsibility. As a medical student, certainly not. As an intern, certainly not. As a resident, certainly not. As anything, certainly not. It's really not. But it has become common in medical field for the doctor to take this role. When do they do it? So the three settings are basically on the bottom of page two. Setting number one is reasonable, and we'll see, halakhically reasonable, which is somebody who's been determined to be terminally ill. What's the definition of terminally ill? No hope for survival, right? They have some kind of disease where all of Derech HaTeva has been exhausted, and it's not going to happen. You've decided that it's a terminal cancer or some type of terminal heart failure, whatever it is, it's over. So that person should have a DNR? What do you think? I mean, how much does he have? Okay, good question. Right, terminal can mean you got a year. You're going to die in a year, right? So, right, so we're talking sooner than that, but there's another factor. What's the factor? Pain. That's the question. Is this person in a lot of pain? So, conventionally, if it's assumed that the person's in a lot of pain and they have a terminal illness, what are you doing when you keep them alive? Are you doing them a favor? So, let's go secular first, and then we'll go halacha. Secularly, there's no question in the world you're not doing them a favor. You are hurting them. This is where the doctors start telling us to push the family, because the family has unrealistic expectations, right? They watch TV. And on TV, you know, everybody gets saved when, unless they're getting thrown off the series or whatever it is, right? People tend to survive, right? So if they're going to survive miraculously, of course that's what's going to happen to their family member. And we need to educate them that that's not really the way it works. We've got to make sure they're clear. This is a terminal illness. All you're doing is prolonging this person's pain. And that is a terrible thing to do. That's why you should sign a DNR. Is that reasonable? It is. That's very reasonable. But it's been expanded well beyond that. The other two settings that this is commonly promoted are persistent vegetative state. Who knows what that is? Anybody? You have to know. Very, very important. Especially when you're going to be mechalik between that. This is not a brain death discussion. We're not going to discuss that at all today. But all the brain death discussions and discussions of defining death, nobody, halachically, and I was going to say in their right mind, says that, but that, we'll see how people would not like me saying that, persistent vegetative state is dead. No one would say that, but there are actually people that do say that. But they're not from a religious perspective, they just want to arbitrarily define life as ending when cognition ends. If you're not capable of thought and thinking and consciousness, then for sure you're dead, right? It's sort of like Francis Crick. Anyone have heard of him, right? DNA fame. So he's very famous for this. He arbitrarily defined life begins at 72 hours and life ends, right? He didn't want to play around with this metaphysical stuff. From a scientific perspective, he determined life begins at 72 hours and life ends when he was in his 70s, it ended at 80, right? So. he says, that's it. It ends then, and it begins then. Why did he do this? Well, he felt it should begin at 72 hours. What does that allow him to do? Get rid of all the defective newborns and not be murdering anybody, right? Anyone who's not meeting up to his specimen human perfection model, we can get rid of them, and that's not called murder because they're not alive, right? So he has that arbitrary definition. If you're not using let's say, Masorah as a defining feature of life, or some religious perspective. So Francis Crick felt it was very arbitrary. So there are people that actually will take a persistent vegetative state, which is a person whose brainstem is completely alive, perfused, but their cerebral cortex is out, right? That's why they are in a vegetative state. They cannot think, they're unconscious, they go through sleep, wake, cycling, right? But they're like Ariel Sharon was for a long, long time. So that obviously does not speak much of a quality of life for that person. So that's another setting where it's clear to the secular world, to the general medical community, that it's obvious that that person should be DNR. And the way they put it, it's kind of a dangerous expression. I understand them. I'm not stupid and I'm not crazy. And I understand this, but I still think this is a dangerous expression. They say, they emphasize the inappropriateness of persisting with treatment which leaves the surviving patient with a useless life. Now, useless life of a persistent vegetative person, I hear it. I don't agree with it, as we'll see when we look into Chazal, but I hear it. They then take it further to the bottom. Because, you know, there's that old slippery slope issue. What about dementia? What if you have an old, frail person who's demented? So there also, there are those that say, absolute, DNR is very appropriate for that person. But how much are they demented? And how do you start to define that kind of thing? And this becomes a very, 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 very scary, shaky area that you will be encountering. You're going to have many patients that are going to be in various states of coma or unconsciousness, right? There are different levels. And the assumption is now what differentiates the first group, let's just summarize this little section because it's very, very important. These are the three settings. Someone with a terminal illness who's in pain, right, makes somewhat sense to a reasoning person not to prolong that. Then someone who's in a persistent vegetative state who they say does not feel pain. By the way, is that true? Do people in persistent vegetative states not feel pain? So it's a major debate. But there was a great study done with PET scans. Everyone know what a PET scan is? Looking for metabolic activity in the brain. So they did this, and there's a pain center, a cortical pain center that's within. Who's taking neurosurgery? All you guys, right? Coming up. Oh, you learned this. Great stuff. So what they did is they tested. I feel bad for the normal controls. They had normal controls. They had people that were in persistent vegetative state, and they had people in what's called a light coma type state. And they stimulated them with some type of noxious stimulant. And then they saw whose pain cortical area was lighting up. So the normal people and the coma, the light coma, which differentiates very subtly from a persistent vegetative state, lit up the same way. So they advocated the study, even though it was not the practice before that, treating those people with pain meds. What about the persistent vegetative state people, which are notorious or claim to never feel pain? They lit up, just not as much. So even they, it seems, there's stuff going on, which is always a problem for the advocates of just knocking them off. Not yet. We will. I just to introduce these settings, right? We're going to need halachically to be concerned with these same three settings. That's why I'm introducing them. These are the settings where you're going to deal with it out there, and it's going to be important for you because the tension's going to rise. There's going to be situations where you're going to be asked to do things. You might be asked to be the person to write the order, right, for disconnecting somebody from a respirator. You might be asked to be the person who does more than that, even more, actually takes out the tube, shuts off the machine, right? It could be. These type of things, or stops the norepi. Sometimes you'll be in a situation where a person's blood pressure is completely dependent on norepinephrine, on a drug. So, you know, the part of like the process of getting things going is to stop that. Now, that's going to be something that halachically is going to definitely be awesome. I'll tell you right now. Once a bag of norepi is hanging and the person's blood pressure is being maintained by it, I don't think there's going to be really any. The most liberal shita that we're going to see is not going to say you can actually stop that and immediately result in the demise of that patient. But that doesn't mean you have to start it. So we'll get to that. Right. So we're going to get into the details. quickly, I just wanted to say one other thing about this. I want to build up this tension for you because I want you to realize that you're going to be talking about it and defending yourself and being looked at, right? Especially if you look Jewish, religious, right? It's like, you know what's going on in Jordan these days? Anyone follow the news? In Jordan now, you can travel from Israel to Jordan, right? Some people even think about when you're desperate to get out of the country, maybe that's the only way to do it, right? If they don't let you out, the army doesn't let you out, whatever. So, one shout out. The problem is, if you want to get out through Jordan now, you have to not look Jewish. You can't look religious. You can't be wearing the yarmulke. They're stopping people like that. God knows why. But the same thing in the hospital, the moment you look religious, and or it's a religious family, you're going to notice the attending is going to like react. Because they know, or they have this assumption that we're coming at them with a completely different worldview than what is the accepted medical establishment practice. Why is that so? So it could be related to a study. Somebody actually studied this issue. So on page 3, on the top, this was done actually at my hospital, right? They looked at the effects of religiosity on patients' perceptions of DNR. And what they found was that the belief that DNR decisions are morally wrong was predicted by certain religious practices. And now, see if this describes you. See if you feel this describes you. Near daily meditation, near daily thinking about God, and the current practice of meditation, and by endorsement of the statement, my faith sometimes restricts my action. Who was just described? I feel like I was described, basically. That's me, right? So what about those people? Those people tend to be against DNR. So it's very interesting. Now, this was done at Columbia where there's, I'd say, 40% of the patients are Catholic, 20% are Protestant, 20% are Jewish, and amongst the Jewish, a high percentage of the Orthodox. They're always looking to go to whatever. So there is some truth to this, right? It's definitely true that Orthodox people pause much more, and religious other people. Religious Catholics is the same thing. They're going to be some religious people who view the Orthodox view that I'm going to be, going over as incredibly liberal and flexible, especially Rav Schechter's Shlita, which we're going to be talking about. But anyone who has that spiritual bent is automatically going to be stamped, and there's going to be nervousness, and there's going to be discussion. The truth is, though, if you look at the Makoros on page 3, it's not really true. It's not so true that we're that far off in our basic thinking. What does that mean? Well, are we like just fearful of death? Does Yadus promote the idea that, you should live forever? No, right? Everyone knows from Koheles, right? Eis Lamus. But more than that, there's many, many statements in Chazal that, the greatest gift, right, was the fact that life has finitude to it. Right? But I'll just give you one example of this, aside from the famous one. There's a gruz, and one of my favorite gruz is, who here says Baruch Shamar every day?
Everybody.
Right? Did you ever pay attention to it? There's a big steer in the beginning. There's a big confusion. There's redundancy. Baruch Shamar Ve'olam, right? Baruch Hu. Baruch Osei Maaseh Bereishis. What's the problem? It's redundant. Baruch Shamar Ve'hayah Olam. So we're blessing Hashem because He created the world. Baruch Osei Maaseh Bereishis. What's that? Blessing Him because He created the world. So the grog is very sensitive to this, more than you guys do. But he says, no, don't miss the point. One is we're being Meshaveach Hashem for creating the physical universe, space, and all matter. And the other one is for creating time. And what does it mean to create time? So the Mefarshim on this grog say one of the things he's getting at is the fact that life ends. That's a bracha. That there's a finite. It gives meaning to life. It means that we each have our mission, and now we have a finite period to do it. Guys your age never think this way, right? You start to get a little older. There's life has a beginning and an ending. You better get it all in, right? Think of every day as your last. That's what that's about, right? So we're not afraid of death. And in fact, the Gemara tells a story about this place, Lud, right? I don't know that Gemara, right? Rav Schechter loves to tell this Gemara. Every time he tells it, he starts crying. Which is not that unusual for a shachter, but I this particular story gets him. It's one of his, and I could see that it's like one of his favorites. He says, You know, there was this place where they lived forever, Shangri-La, Lost Horizon. Anyone familiar with that? Dating myself, whatever. And, you know, in Shangri-La, one of the beauties of Shangri-La, it's a novel, but more famous as a movie. And in it, this guy was searching for Shangri-La, where they would live forever, and it was the greatest thing. In the Gemara, it's not the greatest thing. In the Gemara, Lud, they walked out. They had enough. People would live forever, and then they decided, this is where Trump starts crying, they had enough, and they would walk out. After they wanted their, he says, their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchild, that was it, you know? You lose touch. So, in Yadus, there's definitely a notion that we don't scream and cry like there's not, we fear death to that degree. Especially if there's pain, like the Sefer Hasidim says. And the many famous Gemaras that allude to the same idea, that we also believe in death with dignity and without pain. The Gemara is the mitzvah that when even a guy is getting executed, he's given like some nice drugs to feel better, to make you go easier. So kal v'chomer, if we're worried about the guys that are chayv nisa, that they should have it easy when they die, kal v'chomer, everybody else. And then the v'avta derecha kamocha, so it's barley nisa yofa for a person, a dignified death. So with all that, it seems like we're not that far off in our basic thinking, right? So when the attending says to you, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with your religion, right? You really think that it's okay for a person to die a painful, undignified death? No. Look, I'll show you the Makaros, right? Definitely not true. Maybe it's those rabbis, those contemporary poskim, right? So the answer to that, page 4, I'm not going to read it now, but just if you look there quickly, I cited many examples of that, like, Chelik Nichbad Migdolei HaPoskim absolutely don't agree with that. And we all are sort of on the same page intellectually as contemporary medical sentiments are. So where does the Machlokis come in? So Machlokis comes in on page 5. And it all comes down to this and one other thing. To a typical medical ethicist, and that's where the battles end up, right? Typical scenario will be, you will be an intern or a resident on a floor, and you're going to have a whole slew of patients, and some of them you're going to be taken care of, and some of them you're going to be concerned with the end of life issues, and there's going to be pressure, hopefully not economic based, although realistically it often is, right? Whatever, truth is the truth. And you're going to have this pressure to, like, the job for you as a doctor, you're going to be told something like this: being a good doctor here means ending this person's life, facilitating the end of their life, talking to the family and generating all that kind of thing. And this is definitely what the patient would want. Now, if the patient has a DNR, it's pashut that that's what they're going to want you to do. If there's a DNR on the chart, so your job is done. If there's not a DNR on the chart, then that's your responsibility is going to be to try to generate it. So what are you supposed to do? Why would it wait? So there is a major difference of opinion on one nakuda to begin with, which is autonomy versus limited autonomy. In the medical world, the bioethicists will be brought in to talk to the team, and they're going to teach that there are certain, like, principles of medical ethics, right? And they're all over here on the left side of page 5. There are like 4 basic things, but it's all out of baloney, in my opinion. There's one principle that overrides everything else, and that's autonomy. Everybody should have a right to decide. Ever since the wild 60s, that's when it all began. Right? If you speak to some real old-time doctors, right? When in the good old days, when they were practicing, when doctors controlled the situation, you know, paternalistically determined everybody what they're going to live like and how they're going to die and everything, right? Then came in the wild 60s, where everybody started, like, thinking that, you know, they got to decide for themselves what's in their own best interest. And that ran amok, because it even infiltrated into medicine. And I'm not joking, this is exactly historically the way this whole phenomenon came to be. And autonomy became the single most important principle in general medical practice. Everybody should get to decide, even if they wanted to, you know, up to, in some places, Kevorkian, to actively commit suicide, that should be their prerogative. Certainly, to refuse all treatments if they want to is going to be in their purview. That's the general understanding. Autonomy, autonomy, autonomy. But we, if you believe in the halachic system, if you believe the Torah, Dvar Hashem, we say, not so fast. There will be maybe some room for autonomy, we'll have to see, but it's going to be curbed by the dictates of the Torah. So the Torah is going to tell us, at times, you cannot be autonomous. At times, even though you might want X, you can't do it. You just can't do it. The biggest joke, though, is that in reality, the other thing that we're going to need to deal with is that sometimes this whole autonomy thing is a big fake. And I'll give you an example on page 6. This is part of an ethics case conference that was given also in my hospital. And it was in 1998, but nothing's changed. What you're going to read here is MS. It really goes on. I'll just summarize it outside. The basic thing that was going on outside is there's this person who doesn't want to die. The patient autonomously is telling you, do everything. No DNR, I want to live. And that means if I go into arrest, I want you to save me. And what did the team do? So her doctors felt frustrated because they were, of course, trying to do what I was telling you they're going to try to make you do, which was talk this patient out of wanting to live, talk this patient into signing a DNR and giving up. So they were frustrated and helpless in the face of her advanced disease, but promised to follow her wishes. In the middle of the night, during the second week of admission, she went into cardiac arrest. A code was called, resuscitation was initiated with a bag and mask, chest compressions, epi and atropine were called for, right? Epi and atropine, the heart rate's getting slow, which means that it's imminent asystole death, etc. So what you're going to do, ABCs of an arrest, epinephrine, atropine, right? They were called for by the resident, but were secretly injected into the mattress instead of the patient's intravenous line. After one round of medications, they said, call the code. It's over. Now, you think that's fiction? It's not. Not at all. And where's the autonomy? That's autonomy. The person wants to live. But who's making the judgment? Yeah. Well, they didn't kill her. You know, I won't go that far. They let her die against her wishes.
In the hospital, the chance of her living is high enough. Had they injected her?
No, I mean, like, let's say by the data from before, whatever it was, they did the wrong thing, right? In my view. Now, you would have thought that would have come out of that conference, right? But maybe that was this was like for medical students and residents and health staff, this conference. I was like expecting, oh, they're going to really tell them this is not the way to go. But no, that was actually not the upshot, the way I understood it. And in fact, you can see at the end, in these cases, there's often discord between the expectations of the hospital staff and those of the patient and his or her family or healthcare proxy. Again, they think everybody's meant to live forever and everybody can live forever. That's the big mistake these people are making in wanting to live. The slow code has become an unspoken rite of passage for many households. You know, okay, I'm just warning you, this is something that you are going to confront. You do not have to give in to it. Don't give in to the peer pressure. Now, I will admit that it's motivated. We think it's motivated because these people are murderers and cruel. No, it's motivated by compassion. It's motivated with, except for sometimes an ICU guy, sometimes they have the ICU, needs a bed, whatever, but for the most part, and let's say he's not making an economic calculation. What a calculation might he be making? This terminal person doesn't stand a chance. I got some viable young person out there that needs that bed. Let's move him in, right? That's sometimes the motivation. So let's down the chavschos. The motivations are pure and nice, but they're not halachic. And this is something that we're going to have to navigate around. So someone had a question? This kind of thing?
Yeah.
In pediatrics, never. So, you saw it in pediatrics?
No, not pediatrics.
Right. Now, in adults? Kids? Definitely. It's not. No, there's other ways of doing it. There's a lot of other ways of doing it. If you, anyone who's in arrests, speed is very, very significant. And if you let's say, and the speed of the injection is very. So, like, you could easily do this Hollywood code or whatever the names they have for them and get away with it. And they think they're doing the right thing. They're being motivated. Most of the time, if it's house staff, they're motivated to shame what's right, you know, and they're good people. But the question is it right according to our standards of ethics? And the answer is going to be no. And the reason is because we're going to be guided by the Torah. And the Torah has very, very interesting guidelines. I'm saying interesting because this is a very, very difficult area. Where I'm about to go through all of, let's say, to some degree, as quickly as possible, the halachic approach to end-of-life decisions. It involves, on page 7, basically, three sugyas. Very well-known and easy to look at. I'm going to say them outside. And then you're going to see six shitos amongst the contemporary poskim. And the six shitos can be basically broken down into three groups. And the reason you need to be familiar with them is because my suggestion to everybody, what you need to do, both for your time as a doctor, and even if you're going to do something like where the rest of your life you'll never have to encounter these things like radiology or whatever it is, certainly as a house officer you're going to be encountering these kind of things. And unfortunately, everybody with their own families encounters these things. It's a very tricky area for a final psak. You're going to see very opposing views amongst the poskim. But if you're aware of these three sugyas and the approach of the poskim, you can then sit down with a seil harav, sit down with your posik, whoever it is, and have a discussion, and you should work this out. You should work out where you're going to land at the end of the day, because we'll see Rav Shechter versus Rabbi Bleich and the Tzitz Eliezer are like almost night and day. Very dramatically different piskei halacha at the end of the day. So it's good to be a little facile with the inyanim, and to sit down with a Rav and work it out. You know, whoever your personal, most comfortable posek is for this, you should really make it a discussion. Because even though, let's say, they're going to have to choose themselves which way to go, but if you're telling them, let me show you. What are the inyanim? So the three gemaras are the famous gemara Ksuvos of Amsa Bnei Rebbe, Rebbe was the day that Rebbe was Nifter, right? So he was suffering greatly, and his handmaiden, who was by his side, she's very famous, she paskin shilas, right, in other gemaras. She was at first, you know, davening that he should live. But then she saw how much he was suffering. There's different versions of it. He couldn't put on his tefillin because he had some kind of intestinal issue. Whatever it was, he was suffering greatly, and she switched her tefillah. The tefillah became that it should be over. She felt that she was doing him a favor. But his Talmidim and all the Talmidim couldn't bear it. So they were davening. All the Talmidei Chachamim were davening he should live. So as the Gemara goes, you know, she distracted them for a moment, and then he was Nifter. So what's the message? So Pashup Pshat is that who cares what Amstri Rebbe, all the Talmidei Chachamim weren't agreeing with her. But what got this on the books was the Ran. It was the Ran in the Darim, who in entering the Gemara there, which I won't get into, but the bottom line is he quotes this as though this is the accepted opinion, is Amsa Bnei Rebbe, that at least, and we'll see how far this goes, if somebody's in intractable pain with a terminal illness, like Rebbe was, it's okay to daven that it should be over. Can you draw any other conclusions from this Gemara? She did a little more, right? She davened and she did something, right? So I'll have to come back to that. We'll see how the post can do it. Second Gemara is Gemara Ksuvos. One point it's making, it's a very famous Gemara also, is that Chazal saw that endless pain, intractable pain, is worse than death. It's worse than death. That's a very, very strong shita. That it could be that, it might even be, there's one of the Rishonim in the Shita Mekubetz has said that while, let's say, Avodah Zarah is Yavor Yavor, but not to be tortured. Right? That I'd forget. We don't pass them that way, and the Rush disagrees. A whole little discussion over there. But at the end of the day, there's a definitive recognition that suffering is worse than that. And the third source is the most important one. Is this very famous Rama? Right. This is the Rama that says the following. It's talking about a goses. Everyone know what a goses is? So goses is somebody who has an expectation, no matter what interventions are done, that within 3 days, 72 hours. They're going to die. They're in the throes of death. So the goses is very fragile. Quick story. My very first clinical experience as a medical student, third year medical student, I'll never forget this. I go into this, I come onto the floor, I'm like so green, I don't know what's flying, right? See, this will make you all feel better, right? because at this part, you get past this, right? I come up to the floor, and I'm like looking around, where do I go, what do I do, right? Depending on how efficient your medical schools are, they will, you know, walk you through things, but don't be surprised if they don't. They just say, okay, go to the floor, that's where you're supposed to go. You go up there, and you're looking, and it's obvious that you're a medical student because you're wearing one of those short coats and whatever, and the house staff picks you up right away, and they picked me up right away. They saw I was lost. They said, go to that room. So I go into the room, and I see the intern literally like this in the corner. Not joking. Like cowering in the corner. You know what I'm saying? That's weird. What is she doing? And then I look on the bed, and there's this, oh my God, I've never seen anything like it. The sickest human being that I've ever seen in my life, right? It was this poor old guy, and it turned out he had pancreatic cancer, and he was at the end. He was mamashagosis the way it's described with these noises, and like, she goes, who are you? So I said, I'm the medical student. They told me to come here. So she's like this. She goes, go put an EKG on him. I go, why? How do you put an EKG on? But I did really ask her why. She said, because we have to declare him dead. I go, but he's not dead. He's not dead. And she's like carrying the thing. She won't touch him or go near him. She was like a devout, actually Muslim, as it turns out. But I couldn't touch him. He's a ghostess. You can't touch a ghostess. To put an EKG leads for the purpose of ultimately declaring him dead? Not exactly Sokhanos Nefashos, right? So I said, no. I'm purposely telling you this story. It was usher for me to touch him. Usher. You're not allowed to kill Ben Noach either, right? Usher. She's telling me to do it. The answer was, no, I'm not going to do it. Especially, you don't want me to tell everyone that you're cowering in the corner like some kind of weirdo, do you? So I got out of that one very easily. But in general, you should realize, whatever contradicts halacha, you know, people respect your rights to refuse to do things. You know, it's not going to be as easy all the time, and you might have to, like, defend yourself to some degree, but don't give in. Now, we'll see where we're going to draw the line then. So, a goses normally is an extremely fragile person. The Ramah lists all the things you're not allowed to do to a goses. You know, all these kind of like very skula type things. Keys and feathers and all sorts of things that I mentioned. And then he says at the end, but what you can do is if this goses is being kept alive by a wood chopper, the noise of the wood chopper, you could stop the wood chopper. Or if he's being kept alive by a piece of salt on his tongue, you could remove it. Because that's not being memahir his misa, that's mesir hamoneah. That's all that is. That is preventing, or that is removing the impediment to the demise. So what is the Ramah talking about? That becomes the critical question. What are you allowed to do, and what are you not allowed to do? This is the machlokas, really, is over. What do we learn from Amsavir Rebbe? And what is the Ramah telling us we are allowed to do in these type of situations? So, particularly because of Goses, you're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos for. That makes it even more striking that the Ramah is allowing me to do something that will result ultimately in this person dying. So the poskim have to work with just these little makoros and come up with a contemporary equivalence in medical practice, what we are allowed to do, what we're not allowed to do, under what conditions. What you have is page 8 and 9. These six shitos, which really we're going to divide into three. On the first page is the Tzitz Eliezer and Rabbi Bleich. They are the most machmir on all of this. First, the Tzitz Eliezer says, we don't paskin like Amsavir Rebbe, we paskin like the Chachamim. You're not even allowed to daven that the person should die. He's the only one who says this. He's the only one who says it. He says, it just doesn't make sense. If I'm allowed to be Machal Shabbos to save a Goses, there's no way you're allowed to daven. The Rambam doesn't mention Amsavir Rebbe, the Rosh doesn't mention, the Rif doesn't mention, none of the pillars of halacha. The Tzitz Eliezer says, I don't care about that Ran. The Ran against the Rambam, Rif, and Rosh. Over. You're not going to even daven, let alone do anything else. What does he do with the Ramah? Here's where he says the most fascinating, incredible thing. He says, what I was referring to before, he says that the Ramah is talking about one particular set of circumstances. When it's a person who's brain dead and has no circulation and they're on a vent. What would we call that person? Dead. The Holy Amri, dead. There's no machlokis over that patient that he's dead. But the Ramah, the Tzitzit Ezer understood that the only type of case where you could ever really not do everything to save them is one where they're basically to remove the impediment to death of somebody who's really dead, but somehow by being on the vent and having his lungs blown like a balloon, that is called preventing the yitzias and the shama. It's a very incredible shita of the Tzitz Eliezer. It's very extreme, and I have not yet encountered anyone that really follows it. Rabbi Bleich is close. Rabbi Bleich disagrees on two things. He disagrees on the tefillah. He says you can be mispalel. He sees there's no contradiction to on doing everything you can to save somebody, but davening that you should be relieved of the responsibility to do it. That's how he puts it. Very nice kedarka language to describe this phenomenon. And he is one of the most, and there are people that will ask Rabbi Bleich, Shaila is in the end of life. He is the most machmir active posek now in terms of these things. He really has very little room for any heterim. The Ramah, he sees also in a very limited sense by two things. He says, first of all, the Ramah is talking about only a gosis, no one else. So if you know your patient's a gosis, you're good to go. Who's a gosis? So you got to figure it out. It's really not very doable to figure out who a gosis is. You won't find too many people willing to predict this patient has exactly 72 or less hours. It's not a very pushy thing to do. And on top of that, he thinks that the Ramah might have only been talking about segulas, removing segulas, like these non-conventional medicine. For Rabbi Bleich, there's almost no room for any type of DNR. And even, he says, the one exception might be someone who's in intractable pain, but that doesn't exist. Because he says, nowadays we can treat everything and avoid it. The problem is that's not true, the finis daiti as a doctor. You know, there's two types of pain. There's pain that affects C fibers and other, you know, sensory perceptions in the body. That's physical pain. And maybe we can get morphine and narcotics to take care of that. But there's a whole other world of pain that is out there, unfortunately, of unremitting nauseousness and depression. Serious, seriously, unremitting depression and all sorts of other discomforts that exist that morphine won't touch. So that's why it's not as pushy as Rabbi Bleich presented at the Finis Daiti when he said there really shouldn't be no scenarios where you have somebody in trouble. So Rabbi Bleich is another shita out there, not also the mainstream shita, I would say, the Finis Daiti. If you go to the next page, on the bottom, is the other extreme is Rav Schechter and Zalman Nechemya Gober, but it's not anymore. He backed off his shita, so we'll just say Rav Schechter. Rav Schechter's shita is the following. He says, oh, and by the way, Rabbi Bleich, and it's a poshut that someone in a persistent vegetative state or demented completely, there's no room whatsoever to ever even think about treating them as DNR or anything like it. They're completely to be treated as not having pain in full life. Right, definitely. Right. You know who does that? Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. He says gesisa means that the throes of death have begun. Now, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik is the most machmir on definition of death. He says you need brain death, cardiac death, and respiratory death. You need all three. So he says whenever you have any of them, that's gosis. It's begun. Right? Rabbi Bleich presents gesisa as something that's very undefinable and difficult to define, which is why he says there's no implementation of the Ramah. So I don't think so. I don't think he would say that.
Isn't it Rabbi Bleich that says that you can't sign a DNR? How do you learn from the Ramah where he's inviting you to do something actively to say that it's usher to sign a DNR where you just let them?
No, so first of all, the Ramah is not saying to do anything active, right? You're not actively contributing to the death. You're passively doing it by eliminating the wood chopper. Whatever the disease process is what's actively killing that patient. You're just, you know, eco of yitzias and neshama is taking place because there's a noise that's disturbing the neshama or keeping the neshama from just leaving in some kind of metaphysical sense. So Rabbi Bleich says it's all metaphysics. but none of it relates to any contemporary medical therapy. You must do everything to the end, and whatever the imperatives are for non-reyacha, right? You must do what you can to always save. And the Ramah's discussion has nothing to do with it. He says 99.999% of the cases. So, how could you sign a DNR?
So it says you can't even
you're being passive. Over in a love.
You can't even be passive when you get something
like that. Yeah, you have to always try. That's what he said, basically. You have to always try. Including dialysis, including everything. Rav Schechter says the following. He says, we don't believe in absolute autonomy like the secular medical ethicists do, but there's a limited autonomy. What's that limited autonomy mean? It means that there are certain circumstances where it's totally up to the chol. Let's say, for example, chai shav, chai olam. A person has a disease that's going to kill them, or some kind of condition that's going to kill them in a month, or anything less than a year. That's called chai shav. But I can try this treatment that might kill me today, but it might give me chai olam, might give me a long life. Is that the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? So that, there's a consensus opinion, it's up to the chol. You have autonomy. You could choose whether you're going to do that or not. Rav Schechter says, same thing in these situations. Unless it's something that is batel daitel tzol kol adam, meaning in either direction. So if somebody wants a DNR, you know, they have a finger infection, and they want to be DNR because of it. Right? So you would say, batel daitel tzol kol adam, everybody would want treatment and not do that. Or, he says, this is an incredible chiddush, Rav Schechter says, let's say there's a condition that everyone would want to be dead for. And 999 of 1,000 people would choose to die rather than live this way, right? You can imagine the scenario. Then even if the chol is an amazing chiddush, even if the chol is asking to be saved, you can't. Batel daitel tzol kol adam. Anything in between, which is the majority of cases, where we can't say for sure, right, what the majority of people, the vast majority of people do, even if the majority would do it, it has to be the vast majority. Right? It's the cholest call. It's the cholest call. Now, what does that mean? That means you just opened up the door for what kind of cases? PVS, dementia. It's a quality of life now is open if it's really something that not you don't say batel daitel. It's a koladam. How many people would want to live as a demented person? Right? So if we think that a significant number, and it's not batel daitel, that they wouldn't want to live, that becomes the autonomous right of the individual to choose. Big chiddush. And he also says, his other big chiddush, Rav Schechter, unlike the middle shita, which I'm leaving for the end, Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe, which is to me the mainstream, the most popular, well-traveled shitos, who are going to be somewhere in between these extremes, one of the things they say is you can never withhold nutrition, hydration, and oxygen for different reasons. Rav Shlomo Zalman says you can never withhold those because those are tivi, natural. And Rav Moshe says something else, which I'm going to say quickly in a minute. But Rav Schechter does away with the whole thing. He says, what are they talking about? Right? Rabbi Blech said a similar thing for a different reason, but both Rabbi Blech and Rav Schechter, although they're at extremes, the one thing they agree on is there's no difference between natural TV-E type treatments like nutrition, hydration, and oxygen versus, you know, doing CPR or intubating and all the other stuff. So what's Yotze for Rav Schechter, and this is what people should be aware of, let's say a person consistently paskins with Rav Schechter, you should know, Ishita here, is the most flexible out there. Where, again, if the person told you, right, a person wrote a living will or told you that this was their feeling, that they would not want to survive under X conditions, as long as it's reasonable, that's their right to do it. Opens up DNR for many, many different categories of people that don't exist for anyone else. And also, it means the biggest challenge, in my experience, in these situations, with hospice in particular, right, which is a really good thing, hospice, is they like to withhold hydration and nutrition. And most of the poskim, meaning Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe, and Rav Eliyahu and Rav Wolzner, you know, those poskim say you can't do that. That's off limits. But within Rav Schechter Shita, there's room for it. There's definitely room for it. Because he doesn't really make that differentiation. Why did Rav Moshe say you can never withhold oxygen, nutrition, and hydration? To me, this is one of the most compelling arguments, which is why I favor Rav Moshe's whole Shita amongst all of them. because it is a painful way to go. To suffocate and have a feeling of lack of oxygen, of thirst and starvation, it's not just that it's tivi or not. But Rav Moshe says, that will be extra pain for the person who's dying. Therefore, he forbids anyone to ever sign that part of the DNR. In terms of the whole Ramah, the way Rav Moshe learns it, is the most expensive, and with Amos de Berevi. He derives from Amos de Berevi and the Ramah, he thinks that they're working on the same principle. It's all about suffering. Gesisa is a very painful experience. Even if the person is completely unconscious, the departure of the soul is extremely painful. Anyone who's a ghost is in pain. It would be usher for a person to prolong that to another person. You don't prolong somebody's suffering. If it's a terminal illness, A, gesisa is by definition a terminal illness, or it's a terminal illness even beyond gesisa that is not curable with intractable pain, Rav Moshe says that's the license to be passive, right? And this is the main sheet, and not institute things. Forget about calling, you know, everything beyond hydration, nutrition, and oxygen. You could call it heroic or whatever, but everything else, there's room now to not start. You can never stop them because that's actively going to be killing somebody, and that is going to be off limits.
Is it justified to reduce significantly the nutrition? So, meaning that...
According to Rav Moshe, the way he would say it would be, Rav Shlomo Zalman would answer you differently. Rav Moshe would say, whatever is going to be causing pains of hunger and whatever, that type of sensation, you should avoid. Rav Shlomo Zalman says, whatever the natural needs, you know, natural caloric needs, that's what you should
do. So I understand apparently patients who are about to die and shouldn't
right. And in fact, some people write medical literature that there are situations where hydration and nutrition will be painful and actually increase the pain. Right. For example, I was dealing with it recently, about a year ago, with somebody who was a fight with hospice. The people were big Talmidim of Rav Moshe, the family. And the hospice was pressuring them to stop the hydration. So they wanted me to come in to fight the hospice doctor. Because they said, he's saying it's medically necessary. What does that mean? Why? So he said this. He said a bogus thing. That was his mistake. He tells me, I'm a cardiologist. He was, I don't know what his basic field was, but obviously it wasn't cardiology. He's telling me, well, you know, the CHF problem here. And we better hold back on hydration because they're going to worsen the CHF. So I said, what are you talking about? There's no CHF. There wasn't any. And nothing to do with that. You know, that was the problem. The person's heart was nice and solid. That was what the problem for the hospice was. So they were trying to figure out ways. Unfortunately, they well-meaning, we'll say, to get things going quickly. So you gotta, that's the kind of thing you got to watch out for. Now, in real CHF situations, it could make things a lot worse and a lot less comfortable. And then that would be true. You would cut back on hydration legitimately.
Even with hydration.
Yeah. Because his thing is, he's all about pain. It's all about Yisurin, 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 Kasisis Yisurin, and all the things that cause Yisurin, that's what we're not going to get involved in. And we're not going to ever prolong somebody's life of Yisurin. And it's such a very, very reasonable, strongly based in Makaras Shita. I think he had it the best.
The hospice world is not interested in people dying. They're interested in dying without pain. So I you know, it's there.
Yeah.
Would they ever, you know, at least the hospice doctors that I've spoken
to. Hospices are great.
There's every time that they recommend no nutrition or no hydration, it's because they believe that it's going to cause
Well, he certainly was presenting it that way, but it was a little shit in this particular circumstances. And you're right. In other words, hospices are great. They really are. And they're one of the greatest services in the world. This guy, it turns out, you know, there was a bed crunch, unfortunately, in the hospice. So that ended up being what his motivation was. But
in a normal situation, I can't imagine a time where hospice would say that withhold nutrition with the intention
That was the situation he was really doing. He wanted to have the hydration to something that was below metabolic needs. And all he needed to, you know, if it was legit, you know, I thought it was going to be a scenario like that. But then when I looked into the medical facts, it wasn't really true. I don't know what motivated him.
There's another question. Bill Schachter, according to the patient, like, we also have an extubation.
No, he would not. Because he would not allow anything, right, even if the patient wanted it, that would be an active and result immediately in the demise of the patient. So, for example, he would definitely say you don't have to start Norepi for someone who's hypotensive, with their blood pressure. And if the bag ran out, you certainly don't have to start it up. You can't turn off the drip, because in a case like that, the blood pressure is going to drop immediately and the person is going to die. That he won't deny to. He would never start it in the first place. Right? You can say, you know, you're in a scenario where it's artificially keeping the person alive, who's got no hope, right? That's what happens with Norepi sometimes. And you're treating the chart, you're treating the, you know, you're not treating reality. So the trickiest part for Rav Shachter's, what do you think the trickiest part with Rav Shachter's shita is? Well, that's one thing, but, you know, it's got to be extreme. It's got to be like numbers that Rav Shachter usually quotes, 999 out of 1,000, right? Something like that. But it's deciding what's the whole of Ratzon. Next up, not everybody, which brings us to the last page, by the way. There's three options out there for everybody in terms of what to do about end-of-life decisions. One is just let DNR or Stam no DNR. Don't do anything or have a DNR. That's a bad situation. Don't do that. Right? That will not work out well for a halachic minded Jew. The other possibility is the RCA versus the Aguda. The RCA has this detailed thing. You know, it's kind of following on the heels of Rav Shachter's Shita, where it goes through like every scenario, and you know, would you start antibiotics, not start antibiotics, dialysis, not dialysis, you know, all these different variables, cardiovert, not cardiovert, bad idea. Why? A person like writes that in their 30s, it has no reflection on their attitude, you know, it's a stupid thing to do. And it also is going to be rigidly tying the hands of doctors. It's not going to allow for us to go. The best move is the Aguda's move. What does the Aguda suggest? Healthcare proxy, which means they say get a Rav, get a family member who you think will represent you well, and let them handle it. I mean, that's the best aid. Because there's so many different variables and scenarios that come up. You know that your spiritual and your caring needs will be taken care of by a person you trust. So all you do is you write out, all you're going to have is you give the name of a Rav. Hopefully, you know, the Rav's not older than you or whatever, you know, it's a reasonable choice. And also a loved one, whoever. And that, I think, is the wisest choice. And that they should be involved. Because if you don't get involved, the family, it's going to be done, you know, according to the attending on service is dictates. It's not necessarily going to reflect what you would have wanted. Right, so first of all, I mean, it's debatable whether that's true or not. Now, the most of the postgame go out of their way to comment that a persistent vegetative state patient or anyone who is not in intractable, let's start with Ramosha, not in intractable pain, is not going to be allowed to have these hetera. The exception is Rav Shachter. Rav Shachter will use his same shita, right? So he's going to say, I mean, how many people want to be in a persistent vegetative state? Right, we can argue that it's a metaphysics, maybe the neshama, right? This is where Rabbi Bleich makes a big deal out of. Who knows what the neshama is doing? He tells a story when he visited his aunt in the hospital, and they were ready to let her go, and he fought them, and it's like, you can just imagine how feisty he was. You know, no, I want dialysis, I want this, I want that, we do everything, right? And he then was saying, you know, he visited her Friday night, and he said, Good Shabbos, and she went like this. So he said, oh, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who knows the sheet of Rabbi Akiva Eiger? Rabbi Akiva Eiger holds that your Yotzei Kiddush, but the Dvar, the Raisa. He says, you see, Akim the Raisa, right? They almost took that away from my aunt. Right? But bearing that aside, the Poskim felt that the major mati, this is Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe, is the pain. And if it's not, then it actually goes l'chomra that we should leave them be. It could go on for years. Like Ariel Sharon was paskin that way.
I don't understand what Rav Schechter's case would be where the patient wants a DNR and we don't respect the majority of case or whatever.
In other words, if somebody, let's say, who's a very viable human being, 25-year-old, it's easy. That's easy. The other one's hard. This one would be a 25-year-old guy who comes in for an appendicitis. He's going on there and he's having an appendectomy. And if he goes into cardiac arrest, don't resuscitate.
But why, if we descend that the cardiac arrest success rates are 50% at best, most of the time it's 25%.
Yeah, I want to look.
Yeah, 25-year-old successes are a little bit better.
Fine, let's say the success rate.
Yeah, that's all patients.
Right. Let's say it's 61%. It's not
100%. What is the cardiac arrest?
But I would assume the guy. But people go into arrest after anesthesia for many reasons.
Yes. Okay, fine.
So it's easy to come up with a scenario where. Are you kidding me? Keep me alive, because I'll have a whole long life. I'll have a whole
CPR
normal life.
Could cause,
now, CPR can cause is painful,
right.
Which is one of the reasons Rav Moshe says don't necessarily do it.
So I'm saying that could be a scenario.
But not in that scenario.
But there's no one who's going into arrest who has a...
A healthy 25-year-old guy that has an arrest... people go in for minor elective surgeries, right? There's a reason that it's, plastic surgery is not partial, but it's not partial, right? Because these things happen. And when they do happen, those are the arrests that really are the most, everybody gets into. You're going to do everything. Or, in my line of work in pediatrics, it's, totally that way. People will go 2 hours on an arrest, which is an amazing amount of time. Right? I remember one time there was a kid who we were, waiting for a heart to come for transplant. And, we had to keep him going and then find out. It was like, took 45 minutes to find out it was going to come. Before we can get him stabilized in the OR and on lines and on bypass and everything else, it's just you got to keep doing it. And, there are many scenarios where, for sure, everybody, if they're going to come out viable, would want to be saved.
What do you think the success rate is of a 25-year-old post-op patient?
High. Extremely high.
How high?
I don't know the data, but...
I'm saying, would you say over 75%?
Yeah, very, for sure. In an in-house arrest, a guy post that scenario that I set up for you, it better be like 90%. Otherwise, it's a problem.
10%.
Then the anesthesiologist needs to get another job, right? Because, I'm telling you, arrests happen all the time. Post-operative is a very fragile period, right? I'll never forget. I once told there's something called a vascular ring, right? It means like there's no cardiac defect, you don't need to go without surgery. You got to just fix up the aorta. Right? It's a minor, relatively minor surgery. Still involves opening up the chest. So I remember telling the parents, they're very frightened. This is nothing. Very nothing ever happens. Because 99 in 100 of these, they're excavated in the OR, they're running around, they're waiting for the next day. Kid comes up, and, did well. And we prematurely let the parents in. Didn't stay. And, anesthesiologist still sucking out, and everything's going on. And I'm noticing that the trachea of the kid is like shifted over. Anyone know what's going on? Right? Yeah. And then, what do I know, right? To my attendant, because I was a fellow at the time, stop bothering me. Nothing's going on with this patient. And then the vitals start changing. He's getting tachycardia, right? And then he arrests. Absolutely arrested. And then I learned that was like early in my fellowship. Those kind of things happen, randomly. But those arrests, but would like to let them call on them to make that a DNR, for sure. And everyone who has that level of likelihood of recovery, but even if the percentages were lower, what determines whether a person should want to be saved is the quality and length of his life after being saved. So even if I had a 10% chance of making it, if making it my life would be normal, of course I want to be saved.
But if you have an equally 10% chance of ending up on, intubated for an extended period of time, after a cardiac arrest, you have, brain damage, and there's a 5% chance that you
if the data was like that, then that would be up to the person. In other words, I'm not admitting to that, because that's not true, it better not be true. But If it were, then that would be an example of the middle ground for sure, right? Some people are willing to take that chance for the possibility of survival. That's like the Chayishar Chalolim one. Some people wouldn't. And then absolutely, that type. I just, but there's many that fit into either one of the other two categories, the absolute no and the absolute. Yeah, it's a biggie. That's a very big. That's very common. And it'll come down to the shitas that say you can never withhold nutrition. If nutrition's dependent on G-tube, they're going to say to do it, and it's going to be considered a relatively minor procedure to maintain nutrition. Huh?
Not just like
Moshe would say whichever one is less painful. And probably some of them would agree with that because as long as you're providing nutrition, that's his thing.
Putting the G-tube in, that itself is not, I don't think anyone would consider that, like just the maintenance care. Like you're doing a procedure, it's an invasive procedure to the person.
Put that,
not just like, yeah, it's not
yeah,
just like they have an G-tube place and you're putting food
personally,
in.
Personally, I always thought that the frequent G-tube placement are more about pain to the patient than have one G-tube for oil, but the food pressure.
That procedure
is not
giving them nutrition, that's a procedure that you're
doing. Yeah, so if you could, but you have to give them nutrition. So if it facilitates the nutrition, or is the only way to give them nutrition, then you have to go along with the nutrition. Obviously, Rav Schachter would disagree with this, and presumably it's not. You would have no problem in a case where it was, just turning on help the patient. It's like the person who decides and do it for. Okay, so lo aleichem, you should never really need to come up with these decisions, but unfortunately, they do present themselves. And if I could ever be of any help with anything, please feel free to get in touch. God usually knows how to get me. But thank you very much for the summer. It was really a lot of fun for me to come, meet you guys, talk to you. Hatzlach and everything. You should all be very, very successful as doctors and show me halacha.